You're listening to the Petapixel Podcast. Catch new episodes every week on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Petapixel Podcast. I've gotten some criticism for having way too high energy and volume levels way too hot when I intro this. So I'm
going to
try and
criticism.
Bring it down just a little bit this week. Hey, everybody. Thanks for joining us. I've got my good friend Chris Nichols here.
Hi.
And my buddy Jaron Schneider is also joining us from a different setup this time.
Yeah.
Say hi, Jaron.
Yeah, it's if I sound weird or different, and if I definitely look odd, like if the colors are not right, apologies, I'm not in my normal setup. I am in California right now at my parents' house.
Your face is handsome as ever. And for those that are just listening, I will describe it. So he has like a manly face, very short crop beard, you know, beautiful black hair, still black. Anyways, keep going, Jaron.
Thanks, Chris. So guys, I always like to kick things off with a little bit detailing ourselves, and we're going to really dip into it this week because we're going to talk about our professional journeys to get where we are today. But I want to kick things off at the very, very start. Guys, what was your first job you ever held?
Oh, that's now, a good
full,
one.
Full-time or first job where I received a paycheck?
First job where you received a paycheck.
Chris?
Well, my first job, we used to have a coffee chain here in Calgary called Grab a Jabba. So I started there when I was maybe, because you grab a, I don't know.
I get it.
Anyways, I was, you know, just under 16. It was in a really cool part of Calgary called Mission. It's kind of a trendy little place. And it was great. I mean, I got to make lattes and I did the whole barista thing. Raspberry coffee is disgusting. The smell stays in your clothes for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. We made sandwiches. I got to clean bathrooms. You know, it was actually in a building called the Tivoli Theater. It used to be a small time cinema, local cinema. And then they turned it into this kind of trendy coffee shop. Anyways, I got to kill mice on a regular basis, you know, grind coffee beans. It actually, I have to say, like, as a job, it taught me to do a lot of things, deal with high stress. And so, yeah, it was actually a very positive experience.
I want to point out it's fascinating that Chris is the anti-coffee snob. Like,
yeah.
Jaron knows his coffee. I appreciate, like, a good cup of coffee. Chris is like, no, give me just
diner
black coffee any time.
Yeah. He's Folgers like, instant. I don't care. Yeah.
Don't Nescafe. Even use a filter. No, just run it through, like, Kleenex, basically.
Just put grounds in a tin can and hot water.
Shake it.
Yeah.
He'll call it coffee.
No, because it ruined me. You know, like, if you work in an actual coffee shop, you start to hate coffee. I think that's probably universally true. I mean, the viewers probably have done the same job. They'll probably let us know. But I'm pretty sure you end up just being like, F this place and this coffee and this smell and this raspberry chemical they add to this coffee. I'm done with it.
I
worked briefly at a Tim Hortons, which is garbage coffee.
Yes.
So maybe that's why I like a good coffee. I want the exact opposite of Tim Hortons coffee, which is coffee with
Was that your
flavor.
First job though, Jordan?
That wasn't. No. So I'm jumping ahead.
Oh,
here,
you can't
but
get
I
two.
Hear Jaron's first.
Oh, so in my hometown where I am right now, actually, there is a grocery store called Star Market. Where I was shopping actually just a few days ago.
Ooh.
Star Market is just a locally owned small grocery, specialty grocery store. And I was a bagger there. That is basically what everyone who went to my high school did if they wanted a job and they wanted flexible hours and they were 15.
Right.
You would work at Star Market as a bagger. And my experience there was they never wanted you to not be doing something. So, like, you can't lean on the counters. And if there's no one buying anything, go clean something is essentially what they instilled. I didn't work there for very long. I ended up doing more after school activities. I eventually started running the newspaper and the yearbook. And then I was also doing track and field and swimming.
Right.
So,
but at least when you went out to get the grocery carts, it was always like paradise. Cause you're talking about Southern California.
No, whereas this is NorCal. No, it's cold and windy.
Nah, the baggers here in Canada. Oh man.
They're heroes.
Yeah, I'm sure that
they
was
deserve,
bad.
They deserve an annual holiday. Absolutely. Chris.
Jordan.
My first gig is I was
prostitution.
Pumping gas. back at Strathmore Shell.
You were what? He interrupted you.
Full service gas station. I don't know if such a thing still exists, where people, young kids, would run out and pump your gas for you.
He pumped gas.
That is a thing of the old timey. But it actually factors a lot into my current profession, because while I worked at that, I worked the late shift where no one's coming to get gas, like late at night. So we would just make short films in the gas station all night with my little Sony TRV camcorder. The most elaborate one is we staged an earthquake where we would shake the camera and we ran fishing line onto all the chip bags and all the oil canisters. We'd shake the camera and have them all fly off. And my coworker at the time adopted an Australian accent. Shout out to Patty Jones. And we didn't edit this. We shot it sequentially to take. To like just write to tape and made entire short films that way. So yes, it was a very good learning experience.
That gas station got their money's worth out of you.
Oh man, we made ads with jingles in them. Like, so, if you think pumping gas is hell, just come on in to Strathmore Shell. We went all out on it. So that was my first gig.
This is the talent. This is the talent that has driven our business since then.
I think it's funny that his first job, he still managed to somehow make into camera things. You and I were doing the jobs we were assigned, and he was playing.
That we were paid for. Yeah, exactly.
Still,
working at a gas station, Jordan, is that why you still have such a strange aversion to like letting the gas tank get down to like the empty blinker in a car?
Not even the empty blinker. If I'm below a quarter of a tank, I am actively trembling.
It drives you crazy.
I'm just like, oh man, I should upsell myself on getting some gas right now. It's still hardwired into my brain.
Oh man.
Well, Jordan, your discussion of you making short films in a gas station is not a terrible segue to what you mentioned, what our main topic this week is we're going to talk. Someone sent us a question a few weeks ago asking, it's actually, I think, 4 weeks ago, asking like how we got to where we are. And it was going to be something I was going to put in one of our sections, but it wasn't technically a tech support and it wasn't a don't read the comments. I'm like, why don't we just do a whole episode about it, because it's going to be long. So in addition to that, we've got a couple other news stories that broke this week that we will cover. But before we get to it, let's hit that jingle and then thank our sponsor. Here we go.
So, you know, normally we do ad reads where we're talking about, hey, you guys should buy this product from OM System, because we do really like their products and we absolutely think they could be a great choice for everybody. But today it's even a bit different. And this is really exciting because we're not asking you to buy anything. We're actually asking you to share something and it could work out really well for you. So OM System has announced the last call for entries in their contest. This is something they did last time. It's a community-based project called Tell Your Story. And it's really cool because it's about promoting people, their creativity, showcasing their stories, their talents, and the capabilities of the OM System OM5 camera. So we love the OM5 camera. It's weather sealed, rugged, very compact, lots of lenses available, easy to take anywhere. And it's got fantastic computational features that I personally love, like Live ND, Starry Sky Autofocus. I mean, really cool stuff. So building on the success of last year's initiative that went really well, now it is Tell Your Story 2. And Tell Your Story strives to identify and empower emerging talents. Basically, this is what happens. Through March 25th, 2024, photography enthusiasts of every skill level, you don't have to be a master, this is for everybody who's got an interesting story to tell, participate in Tell Your Story 2. The project's going to be showcased on Instagram. It's going to be at omsystem.generation channel. And basically, you put in your story, you talk about why you want to share this with the world. And then if you're chosen, OM System is going to send you an OM5 camera, lenses that you need, mentorship from OM System ambassadors. This is like a fantastic experience. Brooke Bartison, Peter Baumgarten, they're both going to help you out with this. And so this is like a really good opportunity to say, I have a project, I don't necessarily have the budget or the gear or the expertise to do this, and this is a fantastic thing. Sign up. OM System can help you make that story come true, and it's a really good program. So go to explore.omsystem.com as usual /petapixel. That's where you can find about the information about the program and how to participate and how to log in and join up. And I think it's a really cool initiative just to help people out telling their stories.
Legit, I did not know about this until it was sent in today. And this is one of the coolest programs I've seen, like as far as a contest goes, it's not just like, here, have a camera, see you later. It's like, here, have a camera, and we'll teach you how to do what you are dreaming of doing. And that's really neat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how detailed your pitch needs to be, but I've always wanted to see a penguin. So, OM, if you can make that dream a reality, that would be
see
great.
See a penguin?
Probably... That's your just yeah, that's your one. Entry? I want yeah. to see a penguin? We have them at the zoo, Jordan. You've seen them.
Well, would OM give me an OM5 and fly me out to the zoo? That'd be cool.
Oh, my God.
Wait, I'm just, have you actually not seen a penguin before?
Yes, he's
seen one in a zoo. Yeah. It's underwhelming in a zoo. I want to see fields of them with Morgan Freeman narrating. That's if OM could set me up with that as well.
If you guys out there have a slightly more compelling story that you want to tell than Jordan's, definitely go to explore.omsystem.com/Werner
Herzog narrating.
Yeah, it's a low bar to clear to make that more interesting.
I want to see a penguin. Okay. Well, make it happen for you.
All right. Thank you again to OM System for sponsoring this episode of the Petapixel Podcast. Okay, what happened in the last week? Surprisingly, quite a bit, even though the last few weeks have been really like packed with stuff. The first thing, guys, is that Leica has confirmed that they are going to deliver a mirrorless medium format hybrid camera, quote, within 2 years. What do you think?
That's a pretty big window. I mean, you know, like, cool, that's great. The S system, I feel, is kind of become stagnant, right? I mean, I don't know many people using it. We haven't heard it. We haven't seen an S system camera in quite some time. So it's nice to know that Leica hasn't given up on it. I mean, that's great. So for me, that's the significance of this announcement. They're still making them. They're going to produce something newer. And that makes sense because, of course, medium format technology now is fantastic. Autofocus is getting better. I'm sure they're going to slap some hybrid phase AF in there. So that's very cool. So yeah, it's a positive story.
I mean, they have a pretty complete line of S series lenses, which is
great.
Interesting, but they're going to be, I'm sure you'll be able to use them with an adapter.
Yes, they confirmed that.
It's basically going to require that you're developing an entirely new lens mount for this, you know, medium format coverage with a short flange back. And it means, I suspect the lenses will be absolutely fantastic for this. But, you know, Leica's a small company. That's something that occurs to us every time we go there.
Yeah.
So to develop an entirely new line of lenses is definitely going to be pretty demanding on them while they're still trying to flesh out, like, their L-mount lineup, for example.
What was Leica's, like, selling point behind the S series, and how well did that do, in your guys' opinion?
That was the second TCS TV video we ever did, Chris, was the S2.
The S2, okay.
Yeah, going way back there. Beautiful viewfinder. Is that it?
That's all you have to say?
I mean, you know, I
that's
like
all I remember.
It was an interesting body design. I mean, this is a time when medium format was in its infancy, and so it was very exciting, right? I mean, what else do we have? Like the Pentax 645D was sort of in that period. No, that came out
because that was like our 12th camera story.
Yeah, that was like our 12th. But
so,
you know, this was
it was all like integrated back period, and this was like
Hasselblads, you know, and such,
an all-in-one unit.
Like, yeah, so like it was on the forefront. Like that was they were pretty cutting edge at that point. And it was nice. I mean, the lenses, of course, are always fantastic. The image quality was good. I it's been a while since I handled that camera. I thought it was pretty heavy. Pretty big, very simplistic interface, but I think that needed refinement, and that's something Leica's, I think, really mastered now, is simple interfaces that give you a lot of control. Back then, I feel like it was just very simple, but CCD sensor, oh man, yeah. Well, I'm excited to see what we have now, but I definitely want to see, I don't know, I mean, the S body, if anybody remembers, it looked a lot like the R series cameras, like the more modern R series, like the R8s and R9s. And I get that was their heritage, but I never really dug that. I hope that they go with something like very different, very interesting.
So I don't think it's very different or very interesting. There have been, and then like, I think it was like a year ago. There was
like a big SL,
a big molded body that is of a camera that Leica doesn't sell, was seen in the background of someone talking, like in an official Leica video, and it looked like a medium format camera, like a mirrorless medium format camera. Yeah. Mm. So it's just a big box, basically. It looks like a large version of the SL3, basically.
I'd like to see a cool, like, big rangefinder style. I think that would be awesome.
I don't think it's that, but.
Dang it.
Yeah, I suspect it'll be like a large SL, but they always try to base it off a camera going back a little ways.
Yeah.
So we'll definitely check that out. But yeah, I think it does make a lot of sense. The medium format market has grown a fair amount. But yeah, making a whole new line of lenses is a big ask.
What I think might have happened here is this was unintentional. I don't think they meant to announce it the way that they did.
Oh, really?
This story came out because while you guys were in Germany, there were other people there, obviously. There was a French YouTuber who was there, who was doing like a tour of their thing. You know, we've done the tour. You've never done a video of the tour. But they were walking through that hallway with all the cameras, like the Heritage in there. And they got to the medium format ones. And the French contact that he was with just said, oh, yeah, we're working on another one of these. It'll be ready in about 2 years. Yeah, there we go. And then they keep moving on. And it just straight drops that as if everybody already knew. Like, she spoke as though the knowledge was common, and it was not common knowledge. So
is that person still employed?
Well, they run the PR for Leica France. So,
oh, okay. Well, then they're
high up. Anyway, we did reach out to our US contact, and they confirmed some of the details, but it's like, this is not, I think, how they wanted to do it. And I spoke to the one person I know who uses this system right now. He has an S. What is it? Three? S3 is the most recent one?
Yeah. S3 is the current.
He's got one of those, and he's been using it for headshots for years. His name is Karaman Derguman. He lives not too far from me. He's a friend of Peter Hurley's. And he was like, wow, this is kind of unusual to say this far in advance, because it basically tanks the value immediately because the resale value of the lenses and the bodies is suddenly like, well, if there's a new one coming out, why are we buying anymore? Sort of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's fairly, I mean, before I even confirmed, he's like, I'm pretty sure that they're going to have an adapter. Yeah, they're going to have an adapter.
They have to.
Yeah, they will.
Have to. Yeah.
Because it's going to take them a while to, like, there's a lot of these lenses. Like, there's more than 10. So
I think there's more S series lenses available than S series owners.
So there's 15 I'm seeing in this picture. So maybe. Yeah,
that sounds right. That tracks.
At any rate, neat story. We'll see what comes of it. Yeah. We'll within the next 2 years is, a lot of time. So who knows?
Yeah. Big window.
All right, let's talk about drones, but not the drones you're probably thinking of.
Although they want it to be like the drones that you're thinking
of. So aerial drones were really cool for like a 5-year period, and now basically they don't move the needle much because the amount of effort it takes to fly them is through the roof. But what about the ocean? I've always wanted to fly drones in the ocean, right? And you, Jordan, have shown interest in it too.
Yeah, it's cool.
The only issue that is, you know, kind of a stopper to this is that you typically have to be physically tethered to these things because signals don't transmit well through water. Well,
it's a fascinating medium.
Yeah, a company called Advanced Navigation has built something called the Hydrus, and it is an underwater drone that is untethered. They don't go into detail on how it is able to be controlled underwater, but it can be, and also it can be sent to pilot itself autonomously while down there. It looks super neat. You just need right now $45,000.
Yeah,
it's old.
But you know, I mean, this is doing 4K 60. It's able to go really depth, 3,000 meters, not really depth, really deep, 3,000 meters, which is very deep, up to 9 kilometer range. So from what I gather from this article, because it is fascinating that water just being such an interesting medium, you cannot pass Wi-Fi signals or communication very easily through it. We can still control a drone on another planet, you know, far, far away,
remotely,
but you cannot control a drone underwater unless you have a wire going to it. And as I understand it, the Hydrus, just to understand, is not able to do that either. Okay. So what the Hydrus, from the article, what it seems that it can do is use very good sonar capabilities, very good advanced navigation mapping, so that you can basically set a waypoint series. You can map out, I want you to go to this location. And then autonomously, it can handle that very well. But and I believe you can program in, like, look at this direction, look at this direction. But I still don't think you can actually remotely control it underwater. We still haven't figured out how to beat that. But yes, it knows what distance it's at. It knows what speed it's going. And of course, maps the ocean floor and the surroundings, so it knows not to bump into stuff and things like that. I don't know. I mean, if it can be controlled remotely, that would be amazing. Can we use sonar to control these things? Can we use sound waves to send signals? Maybe. That would be cool. But as of yet, no Wi-Fi. Just can't do it through water.
Yeah, I mean, the appeal for me when I hear about this is documentary filmmaking. Let's go shoot some animals. And it does sound like it'll be a lot of like set a waypoint and hope.
Yeah.
As opposed to, obviously, the way we'd prefer to work is like send it down to a specified point. And if you see something, go follow it, get different angles and stuff. So it's still not, you know, that kind of creative ideal that we're all looking for, but it's getting better and better. My biggest thing is, if you order this, do you get a submarine captain's hat? Because I would want to wear one while I'm doing this. I want to go full Hunt for Red October. And I should get
it. You have worn it in a YouTube video before.
Yeah, but his is like
my captain's.
Yeah, his is a cruise ship captain's hat. It's very Love Boat. It's not, you know, it's not serious.
The reason we brought up DJI in this is the company wants to be able to make drones to the degree that DJI did for the sky.
Yeah.
And they understand that the $45,000 price that they're at right now is not feasible for consumers. And they're going to work on trying to bring it down to make these drones more viable. There really isn't a lot of competition in this space. It's called the Feefish. And it's like by QC. I can't pronounce the name of the company because there's too many vowels in a row. But they make drones. They're all tethered. And they still don't really focus on creation. And then there's that other one, the Luna Boxfish, Jordan.
Yeah,
which is just
a housing, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah, mirrorless
camera. So there's not a ton of competition here. So if they do come out with something that's sub $8,000 and then they keep dropping it down, I feel like there's a future.
I think that's going to be tough, though. I mean, like the beauty of a tether, of course, is you can remotely control it, but also, you know, provide power, provide all the signals, but it obviously limits how far you can move the drone, right? Like your tether runs out and you have to stop. That's Whereas this thing, it can go incredibly deep. But because of that, you have like lights. Like this thing's got insane lights on it, right? Because of course you go deeper than what most tethers can do. You run out of light. There's no point sending a drone down there unless you have powerful lights. This seems to have that. You have to have the sonar. You have to have the battery life completely. So I don't see these getting affordable anytime soon with the capabilities this thing can do.
We'll see.
But if they do become affordable, I would actually enjoy shooting you fishing at that point. I just want to be
safe. But I don't fish 3,000 meters underwater.
I'm
dead.
I want you in a diving bell fishing with a fishing net.
Uh-huh.
That's what I want. Then I'm in.
Chase the fish.
Great. Yeah. Okay. All right.
It'd be like that Buster Keaton short where he fights the octopus. That's what I want from you.
Right. Okay. Perfect.
Okay, next story. Logitech, this morning, as of recording, joined the Micro Four Thirds format with a new camera called the Mevo
Core. See, it's not dead.
They aren't making lenses. They're just making the body. But this is a $999 interchangeable lens camera that uses Micro Four Thirds to shoot streaming video, but also record on device at up to 4K. And the best part about this thing is it can record continuously for up to 6 hours. With its massive battery, even though it is not a very big camera.
No, it's quite compact. Yeah.
So I'm going to have one of these. I'm going to review it.
Ooh.
I'm hoping to have it in time for next week's podcast. And I will use that instead of the R5 I'm using
right now. We're doing a 6 hour podcast next week.
Hope not.
We're just going to talk until the battery dies and then we'll be like, oh, there you go. That's how long it is.
What did you have for dinner last Wednesday?
And go into extreme detail. What I find interesting about this, at least in the marketing, is they know their target market. It's people.
Right.
The idea of this is you don't need a fancy camera or like what I'm doing, which is tons of cables, a software, another dongle just to get this thing to work right. It's all integrated. They don't even say the resolution of this sensor. It shoots 4K is all we know.
We know it's Micro Four Thirds and that's it. It's 4K.
But obviously there's demand for better quality video than just what like a standard webcam can deliver, right? I mean, webcams can deliver 4K, but this should give better low light performance, dynamic range.
It's not even just a webcam either. Like the idea behind it, because it has that 6 hour battery, is you deploy it like on a baseball field with like three or four of them. So the software that Logitech has doesn't technically have a limit to how many of these you can connect at one time. So you could theoretically be broadcasting a concert if you were like working for the band, or like a local baseball game, and you can change the camera at will through the app as if you were
could do full multicam without having to have an expert. Yeah, using the app.
No real knowledge of how any of this works. The app just does it all, which is the main selling point.
It's got mic inputs. It's got three microphones and spatial audio support. So, they're really trying to make this like as simple as possible. I think the goal is to make it for, I mean, they basically, without insulting anybody, they basically said like, look, this is for people that want expert quality that aren't experts, right?
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
That's great. So yeah, you know, it's
people
it's
who play in a band who are just themselves don't necessarily know or want to know how to set up a multicam system to shoot a show.
I've been in bands. A lot of those people are not smart.
Right. Or they're just smart.
If any of my friends are listening, some of them are very smart people in bands, but some of them
the friends that are listening, you know which ones he's referring to as the not smart ones. Wow, you're so mean. You're so mean, Jordan. Or, you know, they were inebriated or chemically altered. So that makes it tough to operate sometimes.
I don't know where the bad decision making was coming from exactly. I just know the bad decisions were made.
So it wasn't you. You were the responsible one, as always.
I think in Logitech's mind, you're not going to buy 5 or 6 of these necessarily because they're very expensive. I think this would be your A cam, whatever is like the most important angle. And then you can use their cheaper, smaller fixed lens ones. All those also connect just as if they were these. And you can have those in other spots so you can move to those cameras if you want to. And they don't need to be necessarily as high quality. This is definitely aimed at people who are already using the Mevo system, which came out like 4 years ago.
Right.
So,
yeah, I've used the basic system with Tyler Stallman when I was on his show, and it was actually pretty elegant. It was a pretty cool little
system. Now imagine that with a sensor like four or five times as big. Better lenses.
The one big question I have is Panasonic already brought out the BG-H1, mm-hmm. which is their box camera.
Their box camera does
have like plug it into software, multi-camera support. They're going after this exact same market. The issue there was it was still just contrast-based autofocus. So it was very wibbly-wobbly, which is something they were known for before. And there's absolutely nothing in this specifying if they've got phase detect autofocus.
Yeah,
so, not a thing.
I'd love to find out more.
We're going to know. If it wibble wobbles while I'm using it, we know it's not great.
There you go. Put two specular light sources behind you, Jaron, and talk to camera, and we'll know within 10 seconds.
I've got this. This is actually a spotlight over here behind me, so we could do that.
Oh, you'll see window panes. You'll see the window panes pulsing and stuff. It'll be garbage.
Okay.
Answers will be forthcoming.
We'll find out. We'll see. Hopefully next time on Dragon Ball Z. I mean, on the podcast, we'll know. Okay.
We've renamed the podcast.
Anyone who's listening,
there may be a
throw back to Toonami next time on Dragon Ball Z. All right, final story of the week. I only put this in here because you guys have it. If you have any teaser opinions, because you're doing a video soon, 7 Artisans announced their first autofocus full frame lens. It's a 50mm f1.8 for $230.
Yeah.
Screaming deal. I'm not going to grab it because I tried to grab a product last week and it totally
screwed up my video feed and
disaster struck. So I'm not going to grab it. But it's big, right, Chris?
Yeah. I mean, as Jaron said, we do have sort of, I wouldn't call it a review, but we do have a look at it. We actually talk about, we got samples, all that kind of stuff. It is very large. That is the one thing you notice right off the bat. You know, metal construction is pretty typical for 7 Artisans and a lot of the Chinese lens manufacturers. So it's got that kind of bulky feel. A normal Nifty 50 51.8 would often be way smaller and lighter than this. This is a monstrosity, but it does seem to be quite sharp, and that was impressive. Yes. You know, looking at the samples, it still has some of the quirkiness that you expect out of a lot of these lens manufacturers, as far as like the way flare represents, you know, lens coatings, that kind of stuff. But I was very impressed by the autofocusing. It was accurate. It was quiet. It was smooth. You know, we were looking with pre-production kind of stuff, and we'll have to see when we get full production how they really perform as far as tracking and eye detect and all that. But it worked very well autofocus wise, and it is sharp even at 1.8 wide open. It's sharp. It's nice. So yeah, there's some things I don't like about it, and we can talk about that in our video. But it's a nice thing to see that we have these manufacturers able to make autofocusing lenses. And remember, not just autofocus, but also electronic communication with the EXIF data. Because otherwise, every time I've tested these in the past on the things, then I have to like remember, what aperture did I shoot that photo at, right? Like what focal length was it at if it was a zoom? And my God, that's a disaster. It's a nightmare. And we would even do things like do star ratings if the camera supported it. So wide open would be 0 star. And then I'd put a star for every full aperture that I stopped down, right? Wow. Like, yeah, it's crazy. Well,
and not everybody here reviews cameras, but it's also infuriating that you have to manually set your focal length for your stabilizer to work well, which I have forgotten to do. 93% of the time.
I just don't bother. Yeah. I just don't bother.
Forget.
Yeah.
Well, that's coming out soon if anyone's interested. It's not the only lens that you'll be talking about in that video.
So. No.
No, Chinese manufacturers are making big strides. That's why we wanted to do this. I do want to quickly throw out, like, if you're in Sony, there's a ton of options for you, a lot of compact ones and even a lot of Chinese manufacturers with autofocus. But if you're in Z mount, Nikon has a beautiful 51.8, which is very expensive.
Yes.
So this would be a great alternative if you don't want to spend $650 on your,
know, $230. Not, it's nothing. Yeah.
That's wild.
Third the price.
Yeah.
I feel almost like in the mirrorless market, we've gone away from that nifty 50, right? Like they used to be dirt cheap for SLRs.
Yeah. But when it came to mirrorless. Canon one. I think the plastic Canon one, that was one of my first lenses.
Yeah.
$100.
And then Yang Nuo recreated it for even less money, right? Like, so, so this, having an option for $230 to have a decent 50 mil, that has the convenience. That's pretty cool. And the only thing I will say, if you look at their sample images, unless they use very warm lighting, it does have a cool tone. I will say that it's got interesting.
That's something
cool
we noticed as well.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, with the news behind us, let's get to our main story where we want to talk about each of our professional journeys, like how we got to where we are. I think everyone mostly cares about Chris and Jordan, but you're going to have to hear from me whether you like it or not. But let's.
But
let's,
this is all Jay's fault. Yeah. And I don't know if it's the same Jay, but there's a lot of Jays, but they always do speak pipe.
Let's listen to Jay so that we can hear his question and then we'll answer. So here we go. Jay, what do you got to say?
Hello, my favorite BB guys. I have a question for all of you. What's your professional journey is like? How did it start? The highs, the lows, and the fire that kept you from not quitting? I think it would be inspirational for guys like me who are beginner. Thank you. Lots of love.
So how do we want to do this? What order are we going in?
I think we go Chris first.
Okay. The most interesting one,
Chris
probably.
First.
Yeah.
We'll try to abbreviate this, right? So my professional photographic journey, and we've talked about this before, I didn't really like photography. When I was like a little kid, I took pictures of cats because I was really allergic to cats, so I couldn't have one. And then I would just like go around the neighborhood and take pictures of whatever cats that I found. And that was my, you know, way of having one. And then finally, my mom broke down and got me a cat, and my eyes were so itchy for a week, we had to return it. I think I had a dream about like Jesus leading people through the desert in a fever state. Like, that's messed up. So
you have like a pet dander issue, right? Because your dog,
dude,
also.
Cat. Well, you know, dogs are fine, but cats mess me up. So, anyways, after that sad story, I never want to touch camera again because I was so heartbroken. So, in university, I took photography because I registered late, and it was like the only class open still, right? And I hated it, and I failed my university classes. Sorry, Arthur Nishimura, I apologize for not being a better student. I was terrible. I just didn't have a passion for it. And then, for whatever reason, a couple years later, I saw a Nikon FE in a storefront. I was like, that's really pretty. I went on mirror.com. I started looking at all these classic cameras. I was like, this is cool. Maybe this will be a good way to get started. I bought it. I started like learning photography in alleyways just on my own, self-taught. And that was the start of my professional journey. And that's what then led me to work at a photo lab in London when I lived there for 2 years. And that was great because I was shooting in a brand new city and I could get cheap film and develop it affordably because I worked at the lab. I was like a 19, you know, and then 20. And so that was a really good experience. And then when I came back to Calgary after those 2 years, the first job that I looked for was at the camera store because I was like, well, I should probably stay in the same field. I want the cheap film. I don't want to pay retail. So I worked at the camera store and they actually gave me a job, which was amazing. I still remember the sweater I was wearing when I went in there. It was a cream sweater and my hair was like this, but black. And I was very skinny and young. Like I didn't have any fat on me whatsoever. I was probably 128 pounds. And that was it. I started working at the camera store and that was really good because you really start to see the professionals coming in and what they're doing and how they're learning and lots of cameras. We started getting into digital. We had a glass showcase with digital. And then from there, this like tall, lanky dude, really like annoying, started working there, and his name was Jordan Drake.
You tolerated me back then. It took a while before.
Dude, so tall, and he looked like he was in a band because he was, and he liked movies, and so did I, and so that's where it sort of started.
So what
right,
about
Jordan?
What about the highs?
I want to know the highs and lows,
the lows
of your life.
Yeah, and how have you not burned out already?
Oh, well, I mean, if we keep, I'm just talking. Okay. If we keep talking, well, then, I mean, everybody knows from there, Jordan and I decided to start the Camera Store TV because we thought, hey, you like cinema, you have a cinema background. I was teaching photography at that point. I really enjoyed teaching, speaking in front of people. And
teaching
talking.
Like at what, at a school?
So yeah, we started actually teaching at the store. We actually had a space and we brought people in. Now it's the offices for web sales, but we had like people come in and I did my first photo classes for basic photography. And I don't know why I started that. I mean, a lot of people ask like, how do you get into being able to talk like you do and be in front of camera? I always got in trouble in elementary school for socializing too much and talking too much. So that might have been it.
I guessed it.
I know. And I did all the drama programs, like being up on stage, doing plays.
Drama.
So I think that was a big part of getting over the tremendous fear of being in front of humans and speaking and holding attention. And so the only way I could suggest is you got to do that. You kind of got to put yourself out there. And it's tough at first. And it was very anxiety ridden, very difficult. But, you know, you get better as you do more and more of it. And so teaching photography, then I started teaching at SAIT, which is a technical college in Calgary. And that was really good because now I'm teaching professionally for money, not just for small groups at the Camera Store. And that was really what helped it, was having those skills. You know, when Jordan said, well, hey, why don't we start making videos? I can handle all the camera stuff. And I'm like, well, I can do all the on-camera stuff because I have that skill set now. The highs and lows, the lows were definitely the time that it takes to make videos, especially then, like we were both, I had kids at that point, like young child. So finding the time to do that, to in your spare time, like make these, we were shooting what, Jordan, like at night after work or on weekends, like the Camera Store did not give us any free time to shoot our videos at the start. So that was difficult.
Yeah, I think that's the big thing that a lot of people don't know is back at that time, we were full-time on the sales floor and then evenings and weekends because we liked hanging out and making stuff, we would shoot. But then even worse was, the post side of things, editing everything like that. But yeah, we enjoyed doing it. So
excitement, I think, some of the highs were we did that Battle at F-Stop Ridge, which went viral. And, you know, and it made the local news and stuff. And, you know, I think we were quite early in the YouTube game. So seeing that, especially at the start, like, you know, our subscribers are going up and likes and views and stuff. I mean, that is fun, but that can be an emotional roller coaster, especially for Jordan. The highs and lows of like, oh, the video's doing really well. Oh, now, you know, like now it's not doing well. I just want to like sit in my bed and put the blanket over my covers and not see anybody. Like, you know, there's highs and lows there absolutely built into the algorithm. And that can be quite punishing for anybody who wants to get into this. And you really have to learn to just water off a duck's back. It, you know, the negative comments that you'll get invariably, that again, you just have to learn to deal with. That can be really difficult. So it is like this, being a YouTuber is kind of this like bipolar lifestyle in some ways. And I think that can be very taxing. That's why I think a lot of people burn out and struggle with it. And so a big part of it is that we've had the both of us. I think that's been a big part of why we're still doing it. I don't know how these like single YouTubers do it. That can be very difficult and very lonely.
Yeah, I could see like if it was just one of us, if you get stuck in like a rut, I could see how that could be really difficult. Like a lot of the time, I feel like if I'm really down, Chris picks up the slack and he's up when we're out shooting and vice versa quite often to just kind of like, because if you're like sitting looking at a bunch of bad comments that have really made you grumpy, it's tough to be like, I want to come up with a funny bit for the episode. You just want to get through it. And I think that's when people start to really burn out on it. And that's part of how we've been able to do that for sure.
All right, Jordan. Yeah. Jordan, what's your journey? How did you get? Well, take us all the way to when you guys met at the Camera Store, because
ours are quite interlinked.
They really are.
So starting, I'm going to take myself back to the gas station where you were rustling bags with fishing line.
You made Earthquake, the greatest gas station movie of all time.
It is a classic of the genre. I was really lucky. This is why I'm a big supporter of like, you know, in high schools getting some technical programs and stuff like that, because they developed a brand new high school when I was in grade 11. And part of that was they got a bunch of video equipment. Like they got an Avid editor, a bunch of mini DV cameras, and I got absolutely fixated on using those. They actually built a module for me, just like, oh, just go do like video production. We only have one credit that you can get for it, but we'll give you a bunch more if you just keep making stuff. You know, I had the option. I was going to go on a trip to Europe. This is right after September 11th. So everything was closed. Oh, I didn't know that. So I said like, oh, I'm going to take that money and buy a camcorder. So, yeah, something good came out of 9/11, which just didn't.
I was in Europe when 9/11 happened. So yeah.
You were working at the,
I was so in
here,
London.
We can cross cut the timeline here. So I was all about just like constantly filming, making video. And it's funny you mentioned the public speaking thing, Chris, is I was mortified of public speaking. Like I would not get out in front of people. So that's why video was so much fun. I could stay behind the camera or even if I'm on it, you know, do 18 takes. There's no audience or whatever. So that was a real means of me like, yeah, trying to be entertaining. So right after high school, I went and made a short film with my friends called The List. I made that with Tyler Hauser and Grant Tingley, which got into the Red Deer Film Festival. It was just like a dumb black comedy. It's like a 7-minute short, but black and white. And that was the first time I actually like paid attention to like action, like shot listed things, thought about composition, line of action, things like that. And I love doing that. So I was like, I'm going to really take this up a level. Took single camera production at SATE before Chris was teaching there, actually, oddly enough. And then went to Vancouver Island to take documentary filmmaking at that point. I was like, I kind of want to have both. It seems like commercial video is where it's going. But the course was canceled. So I lived on Vancouver Island achieving nothing for a very long time. That's when I worked at Tim Hortons, slinging terrible coffee. I know it's unpatriotic at this point, but I don't care. Tim Hortons coffee is bad for you.
I think most Canadians actually will agree with you that it's not good.
I mean, some people.
Every time we're in the States, so I'm like, Jaron, can we go to Dunkin' Donuts? And then you're like, no, Dunkin' Donuts is crap. We're
it's
not
the
going
Tim Hortons of America.
I refuse really to bad. Take you. And I'm like, this is fascinating for me, though.
Okay.
This is a cultural experience.
The next time we're together, which will be very soon, I will take you to a Dunkin' Donuts.
Dunkin' Donuts. Plus,
cheap.
I like crappy
I'm
coffee.
Sleep in that day.
Yeah. I will have already had coffee at that point. I'm not drinking Dunkin'.
Yeah.
Not drinking at Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, so I'm on. I would certainly consider this a low point. I'm on the island, not doing what I want to do. So I came back to Calgary, dejected and defeated, and walked into a Black's Photography to buy metal evaporated digital 8 tapes.
Oh, damn!
And I was a snob about my tapes. I was like, "It's metal evaporated or nothing, baby." Panasonic made the best ones, and they're like, "What the hell is a metal evaporated tape?" I started explaining it, and the boss is just like, do you want a job?
Because all these idiots have no idea what they're talking about. Yeah,
I looked behind the counter. The assistant manager was like super cute. So I'm like, okay, I'm definitely going to jump on that. And I had no interest in photography, knew nothing about it. They had like two camcorders in the showcase and they didn't have anyone who knew about video. So that was really when I started. I got in there like, you need to know things about photography to work at a camera store. So I just started like constantly researching. Like I was just on DP Review and Steve's Digicams every night, hoping I'd be able to do my job the next day.
But wait, Jordan, didn't you literally jump on the assistant manager?
That was later, but the assistant man, spoiler, jumping ahead a little ways.
Before you move on,
my future
the
wife,
Steve Digicam
Evelyn.
Thing, there was during press trips, there was always, I can't remember his name now because in my mind, I always called him Steve. He wasn't Steve because Steve's Digicams didn't have a Steve that was at these things, but it was this one guy who worked there and I would always see him be like, it's Steve Digicam. And that's my only thing I have to add to that. That's it. You may continue.
It's amazing how much time I spent on those websites. It's crazy. But then I got into photography in a big way because I was kind of – I kind of hit that threshold if you remember at that point. Like it was basically you shot on like digital tape and everything looked like a bad independent film, or you needed the budget to shoot on film if you wanted something that looked good, which I was not going to get access to at that point. So I got really into photography because you could get like professional results, was something possible for a normal person to do. And got deeply into photography, wound up moving over to the camera store. because I wanted kind of that next step up. The owner of the camera store, it's funny, was actually constantly at Black's Photography trying to recruit my wife, not me. And I was just like standing beside her. I was like, well, if you really want a person, like, you know, she's an assistant manager here. She outranks me like crazy, but I'm just a lowly salesperson. I'll take a job over there. And yeah, went over. And it's funny, when I came to the camera store, Chris was on vacation for 2 weeks. And I just kept hearing like, oh, just wait till Chris gets back. Like, yeah. This guy.
Everybody warns.
Everybody talked about just like the conversations he's going to throw in your face are so incredibly inappropriate for a workplace environment. And then it's he came back and we hit it off like almost immediately.
Yeah, because Jordan's insanely inappropriate and loves cinema. Yes.
Yeah. And that's how we hit things off. So yeah, that brings us to kind of our convergence point there. I definitely have a, like, I would say the high points for me, I mean, Battle at F-Stop Ridge released, and then I went to Cinegear like 2 days after that, which is a big like show, and everybody knew who we were and what we were doing.
Oh, that's
and that
cool.
was kind of over the course of that year. We'd had some other, like the Fujifilm X100 video came out. We had a shootout between a super zoom camera and a 300 to 800 millimeter enormous that Sigma lens that went like semi-viral as well. And that was really different to just suddenly show up. People knew who we were and opportunities were like, hey, you want to test this? You want to do this? Is when it started to first feel like, oh man, this is actually like turning into something. So that was a big point for me. The real low point was undoubtedly like towards the end of our camera store career when I had my first kid. And it was like our process of shooting on, you know, at that point they'd even given us a shoot day, but to maintain the post-production, go to work 9 to 5 and then come home. And, you know, back then my wife and I understood like we get home, we work, but when you have a kid, it was completely unsustainable. And I just needed to lose the, you know, the 9 to 5 and focus on the video production. That's when we went to DP review. So yeah, you can see kind of towards the end of the camera store episodes there, there's not as much like, you know, creativity bits, things like that. I was just completely checked out and exhausted.
Yeah.
And then DP review, really going over there and making videos full time kind of restored my excitement about making video, which is still, I still love doing it. Like I was so happy editing the saxophone bit in our recent SL3 from Germany. I'm like, Chris, we're going to throw it. It's going to be like a little Gaussian blur, picture in picture of the sax man. It's going to be great.
No sax
man. You know, he can attest on the airplane. I'm just giggling. Like I want to do something in every video that makes me happy.
People have to understand like the mental fortitude it takes to have to like work with me like every day, pretty much go on vacation with me.
Yeah.
Stare at my face ad nauseum, right?
I'm doing it right now.
Right now. I know, right? And then later you're going to be doing it on the computer, right? Listening to me talk. Like, Jordan is probably my biggest fan, right? Can we say that? Is that true, Jordan? You're just my biggest fan because, like, I'm so great to work with.
Jaron, let's make that a merch thing. Is Chris's biggest fan. in a large, please.
Or can we just get shirts where there's an arrow pointing and it says, I'm his biggest fan, and I just stand that direction?
Well, then you have to wear one, too.
Yeah.
No, no, it'll just be an arrow facing upwards.
Yeah.
yeah. That's a good transition to merch. We are close, as you can see. Anyone watching YouTube, we're close. I'm doing actual testing of clothes now.
You got the Petapixel merch. Yeah. I look at this. I broke out the old TCS TV merch.
Yeah, it's a nice looking shirt.
Yeah, we made that, you know, like TCS TV was a great time. I think like, you know, that's our start. We worked there for a long time and we really built that. Like that was our baby, right, Jordan? Like TCS TV was our baby that we had together and we nurtured it, we grew it, we raised it, and then we passed it off to somebody else to take care of. Like that you let your kids go do their own thing. But it also, I look fondly back to those days. Like that was, we were having fun and we were like really learning and making mistakes and stuff like that. But then what was really neat to see and what I'm really grateful for is that our fans and our viewers and such, they didn't really say, oh, you're the TCS TV guys. Specifically, I mean, they say that all the time, but they're like, it wasn't just TCS TV. Chris and Jordan became the brand. And that's been really good to then like, you know, moving to DP review, we're like, oh my God, is this it? Like, are we just going to crash and burn? But everyone's like, no, like it's Chris and Jordan. And then like moving to Petapixel, we're like, oh, we're starting over again. Everybody's like, you're crazy. But it turns out the brand is Chris and Jordan. And so that's really nice to see. That's been a high point for me, that people like the dynamic that we have, and that's what they attune to. But
even YouTube knows that it's Chris and Jordan, because it didn't even seem, people have been continually, if they aren't subscribed to Petapixel, which they should be, please hit subscribe. You guys were still being served to them. Some didn't even realize that you weren't where you were, because
I'm excited for the merch, because as you can see, this shirt doesn't fit very well, but it shows off the kendo guns. Look at that. Oh, the kendo guns.
Mine is like fully transparent at this point. It's
threadbare.
It looks like I just like dumped grease on it, is the like level of consistency on it, but it's just, no.
That's why you're not wearing it?
For a long time. The one thing I forgot to mention when I was walking through there is...
how you jumped on your wife.
You
jumped on your wife.
Yeah, at a certain point. And that was decision I made that led to all good things in my life. One other thing is, on the side, I did have the opportunity to do like a few like filmmaking things over the course of the years. So like I did a film, Metanoia, for Levi Hallwell. It was the first time like I, you know, worked as a cinematographer. And that was such a huge kick for me to just suddenly think about, like, focus on lighting, camera placement and stuff. And I think you can see our show suddenly got a lot better looking immediately after that. I got to do it again with A Walk Down to Water when we were in the DP review days, which early days of it, which again, I think was just such a good, like, you know, creative outlet. And again, coming over to Petapixel, doing like the Blair documentary was, you know, it's not narrative filmmaking.
And Idaho.
But again, it felt like storytelling. And Idaho is a whole separate, we're going to get into that.
I loved Idaho.
I know. We're going to talk about that in a couple of weeks. But just having those creative outlets that feel like why I originally got into it, why I was running around with a camcorder in the gas station, I feel just gives you such a charge to, you know,
and that's
do cool, interesting thing. And that would be my biggest suggestion to other YouTubers.
That's a good point to bring
do
up.
Do a creative project once in a while.
Because the fact of the matter is, all jokes aside, you do have to stare at my face for hours and hours. And that could get very difficult for anybody. I mean, yeah. So it's a good point that you have to have that creative outlet, because then, you know, when we moved over to DP Review and it freed up some of that time. And I mean, it's a lot of work, but we weren't doing 9 to 5. I went over to a fly shop, you know, and I make videos for Bowery Trout Fitters. And that's been a really good thing for me, because I mean, I get to do a different kind of thing, make videos in a different genre, but also just do the hobby that you enjoy doing, right? And I think, as you say, that is very important that you have those outlets where you can put the work aside that you normally do and have something creative and have something different that you can, that can kind of refresh you or rejuvenate you. I think that's also very important. If you just stared at my face and nothing else, I think you'd go crazy.
To that point, I have shot with other people. Like, I remember specifically.
And you hated those experiences.
We work really well together. Jaron's seen us, you know, we have like a shorthand. We're not even communicating a lot of the time. We know what the other person's doing, have a real shorthand. I remember shooting an episode for the Northrops a while ago, who are excellent on camera, like really good presenters, know what they're talking about. And it took a long time, both the shooting and the post on it. Just a very different way of working, where Chris and I, you know, having done this for like 15 years, I think at this point, means we can do it quickly and we can focus on like the important thing, which is the content, as opposed to, you know, making sure we're communicating properly.
It is a constant back and forth of like, you know, for people that might want to know when we're shooting, is like, you know, we're doing constant back and forth of, okay, what shots do we still have to do? And we kind of just know, and like, oh, let's use this light. How about this frame? Like, you know, so yeah, it does help to have that relationship where you can just very quickly and easily, you know, get the work done, knowing that you've done it for so long. And that's also, though, nice when we then have a challenge to do, like the Blair doc. That was a big challenge, right? Where it's a totally different thing than we've ever shot before. We still have that dynamic, but, you know, it's a very different, like, I did more shooting in that than I did presenting. And so those are fun. Like, sometimes those challenges are really important. Keep things going. Keep things exciting.
I want to know.
Keep the marriage fun.
Absolutely. Keep it spicy, Chris.
Yeah. You gotta, like, really, if you want to succeed, sometimes you got to get off the regular and just like bring some toys in, and like maybe some other people, and, you know, maybe set a video camera up. I mean, that's basically what we do, right?
Since you're not talking about what I think you're talking
about. I feel
like
he's moved off of. Yeah.
But it's a metaphor. It's the same thing, right? Like, you got to keep things spicy in the bedroom and you got to keep things spicy on the channel.
I'm very curious because, Jaron, I always get like snippets of your life. And I joked, I think I have like with Chris, just like Jaron has led, it seems, 46 different professional lives over the course of.
He's hung out in more helicopters than I ever have.
And I want to know the Jaron journey.
Okay, I'll try and give you the short version.
But with all the lascivious details, please.
That would not be in the short version. Photography for me was a hobby that I got into because my mom had this Fujifilm Finepix point and shoot, the one where you would pull back the slide to release the lens, and I would always play with that.
I know
slide.
That one.
That was my that was my first camera. And my dad was a photographer. I'm actually in his studio right now, where he did his own matting. Like, he did his own printing and matting. Like, the house is full of his pictures. Like, you can see behind me, actually, you can see his T-square. And then that is a wood covered in cardboard where he would actually cut his own boards.
Nice.
Anyway, that was the background to it, is my dad was a photographer and like he enjoyed it, but it was never something that I felt super passionate about until I started using the Fujifilm Finepix. And I was just, shooting dumb, artsy emo pictures when I was, hanging out with it.
Define an emo picture. Give it
pictures of your feet.
A word picture.
So the one that immediately comes to mind is like a discarded elementary school chair halfway in a river in black and white.
Oh. Chris, nice. Sample gallery.
I guess like for me in college, I did take a photography course. I learned from a Jesuit priest who actually would eventually be my officiant at my wedding. Father Reynolds, he was my teacher for the one course that I had. And I took it because I had free time. I was a business
student. Did you pass it?
Oh, yeah. I got an A. I was very good at it. I was doing my own film. I was like in the dark room. Access to the dark room was really great. My now wife had access to that dark room, too, if you know what I mean.
Oh.
And then
I knew it.
There's the lascivious details you were asking for. But I didn't really have any aspirations of pursuing it. I was really more thinking like maybe I wanted to be a chef. I wanted to go to culinary school. And I convinced myself not to. And I eventually got I tried to get a job out of college in Spokane, Washington, because I went to Gonzaga University. And a job that I had basically lined up got sniped from me from a friend of mine. They decided they wanted him more than me.
Some friend.
I'm glad I didn't get that job. That probably would
call
have been
call him out on the podcast.
Yeah. Alex Dumka, how dare you?
Ugh, Alex.
No,
ugh.
I'm glad you took that job. Because you eventually quit. And you don't want to live in Spokane for
big
the
ups, Alex.
I eventually had to move back home here with my parents. And I was applying for jobs. And locally in a place called Watsonville, which is not too far from Salinas, there was a photographic lighting company called Photoflex. That's where they were based.
And Photoflex.
I got a job working in marketing there, and I worked there for 2 years before the company just was like circle and drain. They just could not compete with basically.
We sold Photoflex at the camera store.
Lighting.
Yeah,
it happened.
Just collapsed. Yeah. The only one who got out of it was Westcott. Westcott managed to successfully not die as everyone else did, but like Interfit and Photoflex and all those brands, they're gone now.
Wow, we sold the hell out of those brands at the
Photoflex
store.
Had something, they had a really good product. It was just like they had a period of time where they switched manufacturers. Like they were making them in China, and they eventually moved to a factory in Korea, and the first few batches out of Korea were bad. So that didn't help.
Interesting.
With the softboxes were just like falling apart. At any rate, that's where I really started to do more in photography. That's where I met Blair Bunting, who was a very close friend of mine who we did. That's why we had that thing. And then also I bought ads from Lee and Pat at F-Stoppers. And they asked me for help on social media. And that's what Photoflex used to fire me, actually. Because they didn't want me around anymore because they couldn't afford me. So they used the fact that I helped Lee and Pat with social media as a violation of my contract. They said that I was working for someone else. I was not getting paid. Mm-hmm. I should have sued. I didn't. But Lee felt so bad. He's like, well, why don't you just come work at F-Stoppers? Like, we'll pay you to write blogs. And so I started writing there. And that's really where I started to get into the journalism side of it. Simultaneously, I was like, well, I should make videos too. So I started making videos, and I thought to myself, photography is that niche is filled. Like to shoot for a job for a living, like that's it's very hard to get into. But at the time, video was very much not. There was super high end, and that was it. There was no one occupying the middle ground. And I'm like, well, I could occupy that middle ground. So I started my own production company shooting in that middle ground. And eventually we were now then competing for like the really big jobs. Super stressful. I think the biggest job I ever did was working for Verizon during the Super Bowl when it was in San Francisco. Like that was a super stressful job doing a ton of time lapsing and things for them. We also did like helicopter work for like aerial stuff because you can't fly drones everywhere. So I was shooting in LA and in San Francisco doing aerial work. It was just like tons and tons of it. So I eventually was just like, this hustle is not fun anymore. I never stopped doing F-Stoppers or Imaging Resource or Resource Magazine, and then eventually Petapixel. I never stopped writing because I enjoy writing. Eventually got to the point where it's like, what do I enjoy more, writing or shooting? And I was like, I think I'm going to try and focus my efforts more. But back when I was shooting commercially, I actually was still working like full-time jobs too. Eventually I broke off. Like my boss, my last real job, quote-unquote real job, was like, he was trying to inspire me, I think. He wasn't a very good manager. And he said, it doesn't seem like you really want to be here. And I'm like, you know what? You're right. I quit. And that surprised him.
Damn it. That
didn't go how I thought it was going to go. I quit and I started my own production company. I was making enough money. I did never take a vacation for the entire time that I had a real job. I used all of my vacation time to shoot work and build a portfolio. And then I would spend my downtime, like my lunch hour, and then also at home writing for F-Stoppers or whoever else I was writing for, just to fill. And like people would ask me, like, how did you manage to like transition? It's like, because I was doing everything and I was taking no time for myself, which is a fantastic recipe to burn out, which is what I did. I eventually burned out and I moved from San Francisco, which was very expensive to live in, to Portland, Oregon, with my wife, who managed to get a job transfer. And within 2 years, we managed to recoup the financial losses that San Francisco burdened us with, and, you know, bought a house and that sort of thing. But like, I did, that was the low for me. It was like, I just don't feel a passion for doing this anymore. And I had the same advice for people, which was like, you need to make sure to do projects for yourself. And I still was, but I just wasn't loving it anymore. It just wasn't jiving.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, like all three of our stories, I think what the commonality is, like we all had to hustle and work very hard and really take no free time. And it's not sustainable. I mean, I think that's an important lesson. Like, and yet we all did it. So I wonder, like, you know,
I'm not going to recommend anyone else follow it, but it worked.
I guess not, you know, but it's hard to say. Like, I'm thinking, like, do you have to some degree push yourself, work the extra time, work the extra hours, put that effort in?
Well, you do have to work hard.
Even though it's not sustainable, but you got to work hard.
But you have to eventually decide when it's too much and focus.
You know, what's funny is like the YouTube channel is a lot of work, but it never really feels like work in quite the same way that all the other stuff that we're doing felt like work. You know what I mean? Like, like the camera store felt like work. Absolutely. And that part of it was difficult. There's a lot of highs. The customers are great. We still have those relationships. We even just saw some people yesterday at the store, which is great to see, but it's like, it's a lot of work and you kind of have to follow the one that doesn't feel like work.
Yeah.
Like writing or like staring at my face.
Yeah,
I just want to. I'm curious, Jaron, because like over that period where you were also doing stuff for like F-Stoppers, Imaging Resource, and that kind of stuff, you did dip your toe into YouTube.
Yeah,
a little
bit. I started
a
channel.
What was that experience like?
Yeah. I had the aspect that I wanted to take with it was not the traditional, like, I'm just going to review something. I would look at a product and be like, so what does this mean for the wider industry? So the name of my channel was called Broader Focus. I still actually use that as my main watching YouTube because that's where all my recommendations are.
It's a good name.
I have a logo and everything. And I produce like maybe 4 or 5 videos. And the main issue I ran into is I didn't want it to be me talking to the camera. I wasn't into that. I wanted it to be footage of other things happening. And it was difficult to obtain that footage. Like it's easy to do it in video games and movies because there's tons of it, but there's not really any of that in like this sort of tech stuff. So they were challenging to produce. And not everything that was released was worthy of having a broader impact. So, I did that while writing, while running my own production company. And that was too much. So I eventually was like, you know what? As much as these are starting to do well, like my videos actually were starting to do well, I just decided no, I'm going to focus elsewhere. And
It's a lot like I did that with music. At a certain point, I was just like, look, I can either play in a band because I was, you know, on the road occasionally and stuff like that, or make YouTube videos. Mm-hmm. And I picked YouTube. So you just kind of have to prioritize it.
Yeah.
One last thing while we're on a podcast. You were in a podcast before, Jaron.
I've been on two podcasts before.
Ooh. But this is by far your favorite.
Yeah, I know. I like this one. This is like the perfection of the process. The first podcast I ever did, I did for Imaging Resource with the aforementioned Karen Mindergumen. He and I would talk every week about, like, you know, whatever tech stuff came out. I think it was actually every 2 weeks. We didn't do it every week. And then I did another one with Ted Forbes, our bro Ted, with the Art of Photography Off-Camera podcast. And he and I did that for probably a little over a year. And
yeah, we enjoyed that one.
Ted is really good at just, you know, talking. He could talk about anything.
Yeah.
And
let him up, let him go.
Yeah. But he ended up getting too busy, and the podcast was just like, we didn't have a ton of sponsors or anything. So it was expensive and time consuming. We were just doing it because he and I like to, you know, talk together for about whatever. But I learned a lot about producing podcasts, and learned even more about it when we did this. Like, the way we used to do it is he and I would hit the record button on our cameras at our desks, and then he would have to Dropbox me his
send
files.
That footage over?
Yeah. Cool. So like we were doing it like rough, super manual. And he was using like a boom mic next to him, but then he was using like AirPods or whatever, or I guess we didn't have those. So he'd use something else to talk into his computer to me. So the audio feeds would not be, so he sounded great on his camera, but not to me, whatever. Like it was jank.
I remember going on your show, and that was exactly, my experience was like, record locally jank, and hopefully it'll all sync up together.
Sometimes it didn't. Sometimes Ted was like, it didn't work.
But that podcast is important because that's when I started to feel like I almost knew you a little bit, because I'd seen you on like press trips and stuff. But by the time we were doing like, you know, the Leica SL2 was probably the first time we really hung out, and then Costa Rica after that, I already felt like I knew you a lot better because I'd been listening to the podcast through that period.
Close this window. It's a little bright in here. Yeah. That is, I think, the really the first time that you got a chance to hear anything about me. We didn't have a ton of listeners on that podcast. I think we had like 8,000 people would listen, which was, you know, we felt was pretty good. this is a much more successful podcast, and I'm pretty happy for it.
Yes.
So Jay, I hope that answers your question. You now know the highs, the lows, everything that happened to, most everything that happened to all of us to get to the point that we're at. And if you've
what got it takes to be a peepee guy,
you could get 3 autobiographies.
And there's quite a bit that I left out. I'm sure there's quite a bit that each of them left out. But that's the short and sweet version, which only
and I don't know who your other peepee guys are, like the other peepee guys you like, but we're your favorites. So we appreciate that, Jay. Thank you.
Before we get on to more speak pipes, which is all of the tech support section this week, what have you guys been up to?
Oh, very quickly then, kendo tournaments, volleyball tournaments, as usual. That's what's called being a dad. But look at this. Oh, my new VR design Salar came in. Look at that. It's loaded up. It's got 500.
Just it's a reel.
Oh, it's a reel. It's like a look here. You can hear it.
Not like an Instagram reel.
Look at that classic five pillar star reel. Beautiful design. I got my 500 grain Nextcast F1 zone on there. It's going to be great for steelheading. It's going to go on the Winston 7133, and I can't wait.
A week ago, I sent Chris an Instagram reel that showed just some guy just like playing with his new reel, just like really excited about it. That's what he's doing right now.
It turned out the person in the reel was Chris Nichols that you sent
him. He was Asian.
Yeah, he was some Asian dude playing with his reel. So
yeah,
it worked out.
44-pound grip shooter on there, 200 yards of 70-pound PPE. This thing is ready to go.
So I'm going
to
jump in.
If that meant anything to you, let us know in the comments.
I'm going to jump in because my background here is what I'm going to talk about right now. If you can see behind me, I mentioned before that my dad did his own matting. This office here actually has his pictures on the other wall. But up above it, I don't know if you can clearly see this or not, but I'll describe what this is. This one and this one that you can't see out of frame that are limited edition prints that Nikon made for their 100th anniversary. And they are recognizing very specific cameras. This one right here is the FTN. And then the one next to it is the 1959 Nikon F.
It actually briefly focused on it. That was cool.
Oh, did it?
Nice.
Well, at any rate, maybe it's because my face is gone if I don't do that. But anyway, these are some of, I gave them to him, our contacts at Nikon. They helped me acquire these. There's only 100 of them each made. So these are, I gave them to him for Christmas years ago. And I still think they're neat. And then anyone who's ever been to Santa Cruz, they've probably heard of the Catalyst. It's a bar and concert venue. And this is a, This is a classic poster from like the 70s about come to the Catalyst and get some drinks and food and whatnot. And because my dad worked there. He was one of the like original bartenders at the Catalyst. So
nice.
That's a classic poster right there. Plus the sweet this T-square here. Oh, that's a great T-square.
Are we ever going to go to the Catalyst? Is that something that could happen?
I can take you to the Catalyst. I have not been there in years, but it's kind of a wild place right now.
Well, we're wild guys.
For younger people, I'll say that.
We're peepee guys.
Younger people.
Jordan, you've got anything you want to talk about before we move on to tech support?
I do. It's out of character, but my kid and I have been playing through Metroid Prime Remastered. And I remember liking that game back when I lived with past and future guest Kyle Marquardt, who we will love to get on there. He had a Wii, and we played that, and it was great. And they've re-released it for Switch now. And it just holds up like crazy.
I hear that port is really good. It's like a really good port.
Yeah, it looks very good, plays really well. I mean, the controls were weird back in the day. And now it just feels like a modern game. But it's not really a shooter. It's much more about like exploration, just like the old Metroid games were. But incredibly well designed and feels like they could have made this yesterday, except that you still have to find like save points, which is tedious. But outside of that,
well,
feels completely contemporary and is beautiful.
That's still a gaming thing. The idea is
it?
Yeah. The idea is it's,
what
you can't just
save points.
You just can't save anywhere because you have to plan. That's a game mechanic. That's a thing that still exists. And I
Jordan, you come from a spoiled generation, Jordan.
Just saving all anywhere.
Right. Yeah. Come on. You got to earn it.
For a person who's busy, if you want to do like a quick 30-minute chunk at a time, it's great. Find a little power up, play a little longer, save your game.
Wow.
But I highly recommend it. If you've never played it, just because it's an old game, it doesn't feel dated at all. So
nice.
Fun. I'm enjoying it.
We have a few tech supports today. I don't know if we'll get through all of them because we have a bunch of never read the comments. So I'll figure out how long we're going to talk about each of these before I make that decision. But let's listen to Francis, who sent us a SpeakPipe. Let's listen in.
Hello, Chris and Jordan and Jared. I'm a hobbyist photographer currently using an A7 Mark III. I'm thinking of getting into video for travel documentation and vlogs. I know the A7 III takes good videos, but I want a dedicated camera for this purpose. Mainly because of the Sony menu system making it hard to switch between photo and video, and also the size and weight. This new camera will do mostly videos with little to no photo at all. I would like to stay in the interchangeable lens category, as if the vlog plan fails, I can use it as a backup for my A7 III. I'm thinking of getting the ZV-E10, but also open to the other camera manufacturers. What other cameras in this price point would you recommend? And is it worth it to use a different camera system for this? I already have E-mount lenses, but nothing that fits this purpose. Love the podcast, and thanks. Francis from Winnipeg.
Yeah, my real suggestion, if you're already invested in E-mount, it's such a flexible system. I think the ZV-E1 makes a ton of sense. You're not going to have to deal with the crop factor. You'll get the same field of view you do with your other lenses. The one concern that I do have is how often do you use your electronic viewfinder? Because this is something Chris and I butt up against when we were shooting that Blair documentary. In bright sunlight, having an LCD-only camera is a real pain. I mean, you can get around it with an external viewfinder, but it's something that I fought with a little bit. And the A7S III is quite a bit more expensive, but it might be worth it to get that beautiful electronic viewfinder on there as well. Still treated as a dedicated video camera. And for a long time, I was like, but the A7S III, Sony's not really supporting. But now they've announced that we're going to see some pretty major firmware updates coming to that. So, but I would absolutely stick with Sony and then just kind of ping pong the camera model based on how you like to view your composition.
Nothing from Chris. All right.
That was good. That was,
Well, I looked over at him, and if
Jordan.
His mouth is tightly closed, we're good. Moving on.
Listen to Jordan.
Yeah, Jordan's going to be the expert on this. All right, let's hit up Codrin, also from SpeakPipe. Here's what he has to ask.
Hello, Jordan, Jaren, and Chris. Are cameras nowadays too good? Do we need 60 megapixels, 8 stops of image stabilization, 120 frames per second, AI out of focus, or whatever that means nowadays, because that's a buzzword? I have a camera which lacks all of those. I have a Z6II, and I still think it's more camera than I need. I've been shooting even events with it, documentary, I shoot street as well, and it just does right every single time. My interaction with it is just to click the shutter, it feels like. I've been shooting with old digicams, and they're so much more capable than I thought they would be. They're 20 years old, and they're still putting up completely usable images. This leads me to believe that I would be doing just fine with a very old camera like a D3 or a D750. So, what happened? How did I get misled into thinking I need this? Are cameras nowadays too good for us?
It's interesting. I mean, I think what this speaks to, Codrin, is like if you have a camera that you're familiar with, that you're experienced with, and that you've learned the ins and outs of, you can accomplish excellent things, right? Again, it depends on your needs. And I can say from my perspective, being a person who tests all of these cameras, trying many different cameras, coming from, you know, days way before D3s and D750s, I've seen that technological progression. And I do think it's a positive thing. Does everybody need 60 megapixels? No, absolutely not. You know, all the stuff you're talking about, eight stops of image stabilization, 120 frames per second. It's very case by case for what kind of photography you like to do. But with all that being said, I absolutely love having those capabilities. I think they're very useful. I don't think cameras are too good or that these are superfluous. Like, I love the modern autofocusing features that we're seeing that Sony started that we're now seeing on other cameras. I've absolutely used those every day. Appreciate the hit rate that I get. Appreciate the amount of shots that I get in focus. Having better image stabilization is always a positive thing. I know it's tough because we get into the minutiae of 6.5 versus 7. Oh, now we're 7.5. Oh, now we're 8. Now, you know, the Coriolis effect of the earth, we can't even go higher than that. I mean, who cares? But what does matter is it is absolutely useful technology, and it does open up a lot of photography for a lot of people who might have shakes or, you know, not be very stable or want to shoot in low light. So I'm all for the technology. I think it's great. I think it's important.
I think where the part of this that caught my attention was, how did I get tricked into thinking or misled into thinking I need this? And I think that this is the key point. It's like right. the gear acquisition syndrome of like seeing people excited about something and without introspection, asking what you're actually going to use it for, deciding that that's what you want because someone else liked it. So it's like, right. you have to think about, that's why when all these questions come in and people are like, what should I buy, Chris and Jordan? They always need to know what you're going to do with it. They can't just say this camera, no matter what. It's very specific to your use case. So like, were you misled? Maybe, but maybe you didn't really know what you wanted or what you were shooting.
I guess.
And so that,
I guess the only, that's absolutely right. But I think the only thing I would say is I'm actually quite amazed. When we look at modern cameras, a lot of the stuff that they talk about, all these new features, I'm amazed that there's so few gimmicks. Like, even stuff that sounds really gimmicky, like the OM system, like Live ND and stuff, is actually incredibly useful. And AI autofocus, I know it sounds silly, but it's actually very useful. And having sensors now with great dynamic range and 60 megapixels, that can be very useful. Like, none of this stuff is gimmicky. At the same time, do you need it? Yeah, that 100% depends on your output and what kind of photography you shoot and your skills as a photographer and all that.
Yeah, I think a big thing is how you're using the camera. If you're treating it like, you know, a Nikon D750, for example, then a Z6II is giving you basically the same image quality. If you're just doing single autofocus, focus, recompose, and take the picture like a lot of photographers do, then you're not taking advantage of all the developments we've seen in tracking and autofocus and things, then absolutely you're not going to see that. And you mentioned like 60 megapixels and 120 frames per second. No camera offers both of those. Is that going to be beneficial to you? They're still making a lot of, you know, 24 megapixel, very capable cameras if you don't need the high res, like the Nikon ZF. So it's your own what you choose to shoot, there are going to be people who are going to have huge advantages by getting 120 frame per second on a Sony A9 III, or, you know, the 60 megapixel files. It might not be you, and you might not need to upgrade. You know, I always say, like, shoot until you're held back by your camera or your lenses.
Cool. Hopefully that was helpful. Next one is from Eddie Chaz. That's another speak pipe. So let's listen to what he has to say.
Hey, PetaPixel fam. My name is Eddie from Los Angeles. So I currently broke my 24-105 lens. It wasn't repairable. Luckily, I had warranty and now have store credit for about $1,200. I'm looking into a new lens but can't seem to decide. Here are the current lenses I have for my full-frame body in terms of purchase order. I have my Tamron 17-28, 2.8 lens for low light, my 24mm Sony that I use when I ever go out with my partner or go out with friends. I have a 10-20mm for selfie video whenever I do any contact social work, social media work. A 20-70 for my general use lens, which kind of like overlap when I 24-105. And a 70-200 f4 macro. I want to save up for my first GM lens, maybe a 51-4 or a 16-35-2.8 Mark II. Thoughts? I'm a running gun shooter and I love to take candid photo video, but can't seem to decide. Love the podcast. Y'all are amazing.
So, first thing I want to point out is while we're listening to the speak pipe, Jordan keeps shouting out, great lens, not that you guys can hear it because we're listening to speak pipe.
I thought this was an email. Okay.
But, yeah, he's loving all your lens choices, and you've got a lot of lenses, Eddie. So about the only thing that you are missing out on is like a nice fast prime. The 16-35 2.8 G Master is a great lens, but so is the 17-28 2.8. So I don't know if I would really jump on that as something to replace. But yeah, get yourself a fast 50, walk the streets with it, have fun with it like that. I think that's a great way to go. Maybe even expand your prime lenses because you seem to really love having a lot of lenses. But I don't know. I think you're covered pretty well by what you got so far. Hey,
those two that you bring up, if those are the last two you're deciding between, rent. Go to Lens Rentals. Borrow both of them and see which one you click with. And if you actually need, so because a lot of your lenses are living in the same focal range. So I don't know that you need the 16-35 f2.82, even though it is a very nice lens. You don't really, the 50, I feel like, fits best in what you've described, but try both. Try them. It's not that expensive and it will save you more money if you decide that you actually didn't like one that you thought you might like.
Yeah, a fast prime will give you a unique aesthetic that none of your current lens options offer you. I would also mention that Sony 35-1.4, that lens is a banger. Yeah, 35 is a great versatile focal length.
Yeah, you love definitely me at 35 investigate.
Yeah.
All right. Last one of the week, SpeakPipe, we did get through all of them, is from William DeShazer. Let's listen in.
Hello, Chris, Jaren, and Jordan. I had a quick question in regards to actually Fujifilm and the talk of their new sensors and lens being able to render over the sensor. I'm just kind of curious, since it is a 40 megapixel and there's a lot of controversy about the new lenses and the old lenses and why that's different for that manufacturer versus other manufacturers who have 40, 50, 60 megapixels, and why that's not a question. That's it. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, William. It is actually a question that a lot of the manufacturers have had to deal with. I mean, Canon had to deal with this when they made, 1DSR? What was that again? The
5DSR.
Yeah, 1DSR.
5D.
You know,
5DSR.
5DSR, where they had to make lenses, a list of lenses that would support the resolution, ones that wouldn't. And that is a factor. And that's something that we have been dealing with now with modern sensors, having these high resolutions. And 40 megapixel on an APS-C size sensor is actually very demanding. Even though it's not 60 megapixels like we have a full frame, we are talking a smaller sensor as well. So it is very demanding and lenses have to be able to achieve that. And yeah, we have seen situations where an older lens won't necessarily give you the full capabilities of a high resolution sensor. That being said, that doesn't mean it's a bad photo, right? I mean, you can still take perfectly good photos, but if you have that large resolution sensor, you want to have the right glass to support it. And that is a legitimate concern. So manufacturers have been quietly in some cases or very loudly in other cases, advertising that, hey, these new lenses absolutely will support the next generation of cameras. And it is important that you make sure that you match those up properly.
Yeah, we see this every time there's a huge resolution jump, like the 5DSR Chris mentioned, and the Fujifilm one here. I mean, there's a reason we saw all of their 1.4 lenses getting released with new versions, the 23, the 35. That is exactly it. But yes, like Chris said, it's not like older lenses are going to give you a worse image than they would have on your lower resolution body. You're just not getting the best that it's capable of.
All right. There we go.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Never Read the Comments, the section where we always read the comments. And as usual, I have read them all.
That was a rough one this week.
So we got it. This is broken up into three sections. The first one, the Instax one, the only real question that I saw, and it was a lot of people had this one, is why do the photos look so blurry? And is that just instant film? Yeah. Is that because that camera has a two-element plastic lens?
Yeah. Yeah. That's part of it. So,
or are you just a bad photographer?
All three of those things. So, you know, like Instax Mini, the goal of Instax Mini really is, first off, you're not going to shoot them with a camera and then put them on a YouTube channel, right? Like on a big screen where it looks terrible. You're supposed to look at these things in your hand with your friends, right? And in that regard, they look fine. Instax Mini has never been sharp. The lens on there has never been sharp. And if you look at the other comments, some users, like all the users who already have Instax Mini are like, oh yeah, looks like classic Instax Mini, like still that same 60 mil lens. Oh yeah, it's not going to give us the best results. And that's true. And the focusing capability of that lens is rudimentary at best, you know, and I did my best to try to keep within the distance ranges that were required. But yeah, that's Instax Mini. You know, if you go to the larger formats, the Instax Wide, you know, with proper glass, or a lot of the other cameras, like, you know, Lomo have some automats with glass lenses and stuff. I mean, these are all attempts to try to mitigate that issue because, yeah, frankly, instant film isn't that sharp and getting a better optic in front can help a little bit. In the end, though, that kind of defeats the purpose. Like, people were looking at this video like, why would I buy this compared to my smartphone, or why would I buy this compared to like a point-and-shoot digital camera? And you're like, yeah, you shouldn't. Like, that's not the point. You're missing the point completely, right? Like, this is about being able to like print a photo out, look it with your friends, hand it to other people, let them have it. Like, that's the fun of it. So I don't know, people have more fun, be less serious.
I do want to say, and I mentioned this to Jaron when we got back from it, Chris had probably the most fun shooting that video
in a while.
I've seen him in quite a, like, just out on the street, take a picture of someone, you know, take two pictures, one for him, one for the person, pass them the image. He had a great time, and that's exactly what Instax film is for. But I do want to, you know, pound the drum a little more. Give us an advanced Instax Wide camera.
Sure.
For better quality. I think a lot of people would be really excited. I mean, the Wide camera is still maybe like, what, Chris, 15, 20 years old at this point?
Yeah.
Just give us something with a lot of these cool new effects and some exposure control. I think a lot of hobbyist photographers would have a blast with that.
Moving on, last week's podcast, I got two here for Chris for you. This is a couple of these picked out from a group, but John P. and Peter Fran... Peter Co Francesco. Yeah, they both said, Chris, you made my day. I often shoot F4 with F2.8 lenses for the same reasons. Thank you. And Chris's F4 rant, we feel you, bro. The rage is real.
Yeah, yeah, it's my party. I'll shoot F4 if I want to.
The other one in here that I wanted to bring up, and just to get, so this was an actual question, is from Luis Newman. For some reason, I think that companies should be worried about the Nikon Red acquisition is Lumix, aka Panasonic. Their only draw was cameras that offer good video features and good video lenses. Nikon now has, or is going to have, features that are going to be equally good, if not better. Plus, they have a huge standing with photographers. Something that the Panasonic cameras have always struggled with for some reason. Of course, as an L-mount user myself, I hope this pushes Lumix to deliver even better cameras to stay ahead of. But oh well, we'll see. What's your opinion on that? Jordan, I feel like this is a Jordan question.
Yeah, totally. I do think that is where Panasonic is making most of their sales. That's why they've really prioritized, you know, more video-centric models in the last few years. And even, you know, a camera like the G9 II that was ostensibly for photographers, we use it as a video camera. I think that's where it really excels.
Chris is over here shaking his head. Nope, not for photographers.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. I think I do think they should be a little bit concerned, because even before this Red acquisition, I've said for a long time the Nikon Z8, Z9 are my favorite true hybrid cameras. One, I could go to any photo job in the world,
yeah,
and I feel like the camera would cover me there. And I love shooting on them. I recently had an opportunity to shoot on the Z8 again, and it just reminds me over and over, man, I love using these cameras. I've said for a long time, it's really the lens ecosystem and the interface that keeps me locked into Panasonic. And Nikon's making huge strides on both of those. So now that they have access to what I'd say is the best compressed RAW format as well in the very near future, they're going to be a real steamroller on the video front. And Panasonic had better bring out some really compelling, cool stuff. But I've said earlier on one of our videos, like, I think 2024, we're going to see some big moves from them.
Yeah.
So hopefully that
everybody should be scared. I mean, Canon should be scared. Sony should be scared. Yeah. Panasonic should be scared. Everybody should be scared. You know, I've said I just want to add on here Panasonic, because you do talk about it in terms of as a photographer's camera as well. We've said this to Panasonic many times, you know, for years, you know, and we love Panasonic cameras. We use Panasonic cameras, but they, as much as they even try to still emphasize their cameras being hybrid or in a lot of cases, even like for photographers, it never quite feels that way. Like, you can't help but feel like the priority is always on video, which it is. And also, like we've said, like, they're great cameras. They're functional cameras. They take beautiful photos, but the lenses seem to be geared more towards videography than photography in a lot of cases. The cameras are maybe, I mean, this is subjective, but they're inherently, in my opinion, not very sexy, not very appealing in some ways.
You use the word utilitarian to me.
Yeah, they're utilitarian, right? And I think over many, many years of having that same doctrine, people start to feel like, oh, that's like a industry video camera company. You know, you start to lose the photographers who want a tool that they can also covet to some degree, I think, anyways. That's my opinion, but it's right. And Panasonic has pushed towards a genre and done a very good job there, been very well respected for it, but it has been at the expense of, I think, some photographers. And that's something they may or may not decide to address. I don't know. We'll see.
Make a rangefinder style Panasonic body that is small with good autofocus, and photographers will lap that up. Trust me.
But yeah, people are noticing.
We already beat this drum. If they don't listen to us, that's their fault. All right, the last three here are on your microphone video, Jordan, from Manu G. There's like three G's. A tutorial on how you treat the signals in post would be very interesting. When I tried a first-time external mic, I was shocked by the sound of it. So now I don't have one anymore. But in the meantime, I learned that Audacity has a couple of filters and effects, and there my sound is better. So how would you treat a raw signal of external mics? That would interest me very much. You're not going to do a tutorial, but I was curious if you had any thoughts.
No, we're not going to do a tutorial, but I'll give you a quick walkthrough on my... Sorry.
He's dying.
Frog in your throat.
Yeah. I'm under the gun now. I'm terrified. Basically, when I bring things in, I do tend to record audio signals a little bit low because Chris does have a tendency, as do I actually,
to start shouting.
Jordan's the worst.
And suddenly,
Jordan is the worst.
I do have a wide, I mean, both of you have to deal with my volume levels. I get excited.
Yeah.
But so does Chris. So I do tend to run them a little bit lower and then balance them out to a degree when I'm editing the video. But as you mentioned, I do use Audacity to treat the final edit. So I export the entire project and run it through. Actually, the owner of Petapixel, Michael, had a little layout for me for kind of like optimal YouTube levels that I've been using since I switched over. And I found those really nice. So I'm doing a custom compressor on it, and I'm also doing equalization. So we've got similar... I'm sorry.
Similar volumes.
Similar volume levels all the way through it.
You okay?
I'm struggling, man. I don't know what happened there. Ran out of water, too.
I also use Audacity to relieve Jordan here so while he can get his voice back. I also use Audacity for this podcast using the compressor again and then a separate loudness normalization that's different for audio only and YouTube.
We could actually post that those settings that we use
could.
For that.
We could post them.
I've found that works really well.
Another one from Lucas92. I'm pretty sure that 92 was added by YouTube now that I know more about it. So just Lucas. Great review, Jordan. I appreciate not editing hiss from all the recordings. What do you do to control it when editing videos?
Yeah. So with this, I didn't run it through those filters that I mentioned because we're reviewing microphones. It's not fair to them. So what I did do is equalize the audio levels on them. And certainly some of these are mics that you want to run a little bit hotter. But we had the same camera settings on it and just kind of ran the microphones so they were peaking at zero on it. And yeah, some of them do have a little bit more self noise for sure.
Since you have to answer another one here, Jordan, do you need a second? Do you need to take a breath?
I'll answer the next one as Jordan. How's that?
No, don't do it. I don't want him speaking for me.
I'm leaving this all in. This is entertaining to me. The last,
oh damn it.
The last one is from Posey Music, and this is actually a couple. I saw these come in. They're like, apparently, I didn't know this. It's not like we go around watching other people's videos before we make our own. I don't even think. Yeah. Did you know that F-Stoppers had done a video that's very similar?
No,
they
dropped a very similar time.
Yeah,
we'd been sitting on our A-roll for quite a while. So it's just a weird coincidence that we both dropped very similar videos.
But Lee had a very different opinion on the Shure, which they found remarkable. Other people were like, how did that happen? Did you have any connection issues with it? And why is your opinions are different.
Yeah.
So, well, as Jordan Drake, so first we didn't have any connection issues at all. I also found that the Shure gave very good sound, very nice richness. I like the tone. We still use it in our videos today. And then I talked to my very good friend, Alex Mitchell, who is a sound engineer, and he agreed with me.
Okay. So a couple things. First of all, if you go to that F-Stoppers video now, you'll see they say, like, it turns out the Shure that we used may have been defective. We have requested another sample from Shure because the results weren't indicative of what other people are finding. So it does seem like that is the case there. With the Shure audio, I mean, I used it out in the field primarily. Like, we did use all of those microphones in the basement when I was talking, but that's not a good test for it. So I didn't really gauge my findings on audio quality from that. It was when we were out shooting our show in the field, how we would actually use the microphones is how I ranked the sound quality on there. And I found the Shure did an excellent job in that situation.
Thanks to all the watchers of our last like month and a half of videos for putting up with weirdly changing audio Jordan
jumping from we used $130 and $160 dual system sound audio for our episodes. So that was why you might have seen some variation in the quality of it. That is definitely a thing. One other thing I want to address is I totally missed a setting when we were looking at the Saramonic. We've added a pinned comment, and I've actually edited the YouTube video. You can actually trim bits out of a YouTube video after they're published, just not add bits to it. But you can absolutely set the on-channel gain with the Saramonic through a very convoluted process that you do want to have the paper manual handy for, as I talked about in that video. But yes, we did miss that, and apologies for everyone for the bad information.
Yeah, the PR contact we have for Saramonic is a guy I've worked with for a few years now, and I'm sure he forgives you, Jordan. So
I hope so.
All right, that's gonna do it for this week. Again, for the third week in a row, we promised a guest and we lied to you. So hopefully next week, when we actually have a guest on the books, that we actually do it. But we'll see. I'm not going to promise anything anymore. I give up.
No.
None of it ever turns out.
We may or may not have a guest. It's a surprise. You'll just have to keep tuning in and be surprised by other people.
But thanks everyone for joining us this week. We'll catch you all next week. Bye.
Bye.